Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Two key concepts that have emerged in the public discourse over healthcare reform are health information technology, that is, the adoption of computerized medical records, and the patient-centered medical home, which is both an old and new model for expanding the delivery and efficiency of primary care. Doctors and hospitals have slowly but surely been making the expensive and challenging transformation to electronic medical records over the last decade. No one is more a champion of IT adoption and the concept of the patient-centered medical home than Dr. Paul Grundy, who is IBM's Global Director of Healthcare Transformation and the founding president of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative, a national collection of volunteer stakeholders devoted to improving healthcare in the United States through the adoption of the medical home model. Dr. Grundy will be appearing in Tulsa June 4th to keynote a My Health Access Network community event that will take place at the Learning Center on the Schusterman campus of OU Tulsa. The event is free and is open to the public and will start at 11:30. Paul Grundy is my guest today over the phone in this edition of Studio Tulsa on Health. Dr. Paul Grundy, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Pleasure to be with you today.
I wanted to start by asking you what one does as Global Director of Healthcare Transformation for IBM. That is, what do you consider your responsibilities and what does that lofty-sounding title mean?
So I'm the person that's out front helping to transform the delivery system globally towards a more robust, data-driven, moving away from an episode of care towards effectively managing a population in a world where data is going to do for the doctor's mind what imaging has done for their vision over the past 50 years.
So does that mean specifically that you work with IBM's clients, or are you more of a think tank person out front in terms of their strategic initiatives with governments or things like that?
Yes, I'm more out in front, helping create a point of view. And it really comes out of a role that I used to have many years ago now at IBM, where I was part of our HR organization that looked at how we bought care. We made the assumption that if we looked at the kind of care we really wanted to get for our own employees and their families, that would stand us in good stead when we looked at how we were interfacing with government around a point of view from our company globally and how we were going to look at the kinds of tools and resources we would try to help deliver into the market to make healthcare more efficient and more effective.
So you were essentially looking in a previous position on the inside, how can we best as a company purchase and direct kind of our spend on healthcare? And then that's evolved into this new position where you're really looking at it from sort of everybody's perspective, really. How can you deliver the best care? Is that fair to say?
That's fair to say. And I just got back from China, in fact, a few days ago. And the government of China is very much engaged in looking at how they transform the delivery of healthcare towards more robust, more effective, advanced primary care, using primary care not to deliver episodes of care, but really how to effectively deliver and manage a population in an era where, you know, concerns like chronic disease really require that a patient be managed and care be coordinated and integrated versus, you know, a period of time when, you know, what a primary care doc was an episode of treating an illness.
Was the work in China on behalf of IBM, or I should say on behalf of corporations in China, or on the Chinese government itself looking to integrate and systematize their primary care more effectively?
Yes, the Chinese government is looking at how they can transform their delivery system, just like many other parts of the world. They've actually very closely followed the joint principles of the medical home. They call them the six directions in China, but it just makes sense. I mean, the medical home just makes so much sense from the perspective of, you know, what do you need to do to move away from delivering an episode of care on paper to effectively managing a population, you know, using data. And probably one of the places in the world that I'm the most excited about some of the tools and the resources and the community coming together to effectively do that is actually right there in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Can you elaborate on that? What do you mean
yeah.
by Tulsa?
I mean, I first came to Tulsa probably 6 years ago or so now at the invitation of the University of Oklahoma at Tulsa when this medical school was refocused and renamed the School of Community Medicine. And Dean Duffy and Chancellor Clancy were really focused on, and Peter Bedetti, who was then in health policy, really focused on moving towards effectively managing a community-based delivery system of care. I mean, they are the first medical school that's actually adopted the medical home as the foundation, the very template of how they're going to teach the students of the future, which is really exciting. On top of that, David Kindrick was brought in, really smart guy with an engineering degree and background, and really has been brilliant in orchestrating across an OMC Beacon Community Grant and now the CMS Primary Care Coordination Effort, that's the Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative of CMMI. So you've got a couple of really exciting programs that are in place there. And what I see happening in Tulsa is one of the communities in which a primary care doc can send a referral to a specialist, and the specialist actually gets paid to answer that referral via email. And the referral itself becomes a part of the treatment plan, i.e. held accountable as it should be, and not just something thrown out there that perhaps could hit or miss. And you know, you really see care being delivered in a much more effective way when you begin to take just little elements like that and begin to hold them accountable. The other thing that's really exciting is that David has put together solutions that empower the physicians to really have a much better knowledge of what's going on with their patients and be able to take that information and make it actionable at the point of care. They can go into an application that will tell them exactly what's going on with their patients, what are the three key things they should be focusing on, and which one of those things will give them the most bang for their buck if they actually act on it. So you're beginning to get at meaningful information that is actionable at the point of care in the community in Tulsa.
And so I want to just explain for our listeners some of what you're talking about in terms of actionable information at the point of care, essentially having all of the medical record information available from wherever the patient has received care, anywhere at a different hospital, different emergency room, because typically that type of information is siloed in those different medical record systems of the different institutions. And so when you see a patient, you may not actually have the most current information or the most current medication list. And so you're working often in the dark in terms of knowing everything there is to know about your patient. And so these tools that Dr. Kindrick has developed really are groundbreaking in terms of their ability to bring information to the point of care, as you mentioned. I want to ask something else about, you mentioned a term that is part of your vernacular, but is, I think, less familiar to our listeners. You talked about the patient-centered medical home, and you, I believe, are the founder and the still the president of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative. Is that right, that champions the patient-centered medical home?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm the founding president of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative, and I'm still the president of it. It's sort of outgrown by many, many years now, a one-man shop, and we have a CEO who now really leads the organization, and I'm sort of more the cheerleader at this stage, I guess. I'm really the advocate for the medical home and the transformation. The patient-centered medical home, the joint principles of the patient-centered medical home, were really born back in 2006 when the large corporate buyers of care organized by IBM met in Washington and asked the House of Primary Care, the four primary care societies, to give a set of principles that we could all agree on, and we could change the covenant between the buyer and the provider towards, you know, effectively having a set of principles that would allow, you know, us to change how we bought care and change how the primary care providers delivered care. And those became known as the joint principles of the patient-centered medical home, and the medical literature, a few articles back in that time frame, you know, sort of dubbed me the godfather of the medical home, which is probably a clearer understanding of the role that I played, because I'm not the father of the concept. The medical home concept goes back into pediatric literature. Calvin Shi from Hawaii is the first person who used the term, and I think it was probably 67 or 68. And then Ed Wagner, the chronic disease model, is a huge component of the medical home. The AAFP did a Future of Family Medicine where they really took a deep dive and look at themselves, and they reached a lot of the conclusions around what you needed to do to manage a population. Bodenheimer, Kevin Grembach, and those folks published a bunch of literature prior to all of that, talking about advanced primary care, robust primary care, They even wrote a book about it. So they're sort of the fathers of the concept. The role that I played was to try to help create an organization that would push for it, to advocate for it, that would, you know, my view of them defining me as the godfather is kind of, you know, carrying the machine gun, demanding that we have it to buy, right? Versus the intellectual owner of the concept.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. I'm interviewing Dr. Paul Grundy, who is Global Director of Healthcare Transformation for IBM, and he'll be appearing as keynote speaker at the My Health Access Network Community Program on June 4th. And we're talking about the patient-centered medical home, which is a concept that essentially has been given new life. As you pointed out, it started in the 1960s, really, the late 60s, in the pediatric community and has spread to family practice. But in 2006, you said there was these four different primary care professional groups that came to endorse some joint principles. And I wonder if you just share, I mean, what if I'm a patient, am I being put in a home? What is a patient-centered medical home?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. And just to go back one point, the primary care societies advised me that if it weren't for the buyers in the room asking for them to all agree on a set of principles, it would have been hard for them to do that. So I think that that whole movement, that era was important. So the medical home is sort of misunderstood, and it works in pediatrics because the concept of the home has a very different meaning than in geriatrics, right, where it could imply a nursing home. The concept of a home is the place where something belongs. And what the pediatricians were really talking about was if you're going to have something as complex as a kid with special needs or a diabetic or somebody who has a kidney transplant, you need a place where all the records belong and where everything is accessible, just like you're doing in Tulsa, just like you described what you're doing in My Health. So you can effectively manage that population. So it's pretty well known that that's what you need. So that's the core concept. It's a system integrator. It's the place and delivery system where data goes. And if it goes there, it becomes held accountable. You see, there's something about having data that's unique in that every other business, every other industry is data driven, right? So the engineering process is all about data. You build a skyscraper with data. You don't use, you know, you don't use somebody's head like we do in healthcare as a master builder. So the principles, the concept is that you have a place where somebody has a healing relationship with you as your primary care physician, as your healer. And that person has a unique role in your life and that you're committed as the physician to give them a much better access to them, right? So you should be able to reach that physician via email. You should be able to interface with them by phone if you need. You should have a team supporting that physician to be able to interact with you. You should be able to access that physician traditionally in a medical home on the same day or close to the same day. So the covenant change is really about much better access to care. Secondly, the physician plays a very different role in that they become your quarterback. They become the person who will coordinate your care across a very complex delivery system, i.e., the kinds of things you're doing in Tulsa with that doc-to-doc solution where all of a sudden somebody is actually taking on responsibility with their team for making sure that your care is integrated and coordinated. It's really dangerous. It's really, really dangerous to have five partialists, right, to have five specialists on a part of the body who are doing five different things to you and nobody's communicating. I mean, you know, you can imagine the amount of complications that occur when you have five prescribing physicians and nobody knows what the other one's doing, and that happens all too often. So you get access, you get coordination, you get integration. You have tools that help you engage more effectively, proactively. So my cat has a registry. My cat gets notified when it needs its immunizations. You know, you should too. You should be told that your mammogram is due. You should be bugged remorselessly if you haven't gotten it done because that's going to save your life, right? And great story when I was last in Tulsa probably a year or so ago was visiting a medical home practice where, you know, a relatively young physician with a relatively young patient, and the patient said, you know, that registry, that notification saved my life because even though I'm not even 40, I actually did need a mammogram. I did follow up and get it because of family history, and it was because I was advised and notified by the physician that I was at risk, right, because I have family risk history. So, you know, you have a more proactive stance of what it is your doctor does with you. Also, there's public record of what happens, right? So from the side of the physician, the results of how well your physicians do, how they compare to others in monitoring and managing a specific disease, not public in the sense of your private information, but just, you know, is available. So great example, again, happening in Tulsa is that, you know, all of a sudden we can look at how well a given doctor is actually managing their patient population.
So what type of penetration does that concept have nationally? We're starting to see lots of communities, lots of practices adopt a patient-centered medical home model. I mean, you mentioned the School of Community Medicine here in Tulsa, which functions as a patient-centered medical home. If I'm a patient, this sounds pretty good. How do I find out more about this?
So the penetration is beginning to make a ripple, right? I mean, it's now become the standard of care for the Veterans Administration, for the Department of Defense. Many large healthcare plans like WellPoint are using this as their standard of care. And you have, you know, pretty good penetration beginning to happen. I mean, I think the best thing to do would be to have a conversation with your physician and ask them, you know, if you are moving towards a medical home. But more importantly, I think the question is, you know, if you call your doc and want to be seen, and your doc says the first time he can see you is in 2 weeks, then, you know, you might want to think about whether you need a new doc or not, right? I mean, I don't think that that's acceptable anymore. So from the patient's point of view, it's a matter of, and what they will see most visible first is access to care, enhanced communication around their care. Again, I was asked by a colleague about getting into a medical home in the Tulsa market, and I suggested a couple of the names that I knew were a medical home, and the patient was ecstatic, right? They went there. They called me because they couldn't get in. It was going to take them 2 weeks to see their physician, and this guy saw them the same day, and all of the lab results, they were on the iPhone of the patient while the patient was in the parking lot.
Wow. That is a transformative story for sure. I mean, mm-hmm. I think patients definitely want that type of access and want that type of information.
They should. They should demand it.
Yeah. So consumer demand does have a lot to do with it. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. Today we're interviewing Dr. Paul Grundy, who is Global Director of Healthcare Transformation for IBM. And I want to shift gears here for a second and ask you a little bit. You have a fascinating biography. You grew up as the child of Quaker missionaries in Sierra Leone in Africa?
Yes, I did. In Freetown is the capital, and it's called Freetown because it's where the slaves were freed. If you ever watch the movie Amazing Grace, and you know, very proud of the fact that my Quaker ancestors were very actively involved in helping free the slaves and helping establish a community for freed slaves.
Huh. And did you stay there for your whole childhood and go to high school?
Yes, I was there most of my childhood. We spent some time in the United States as well. My parents were from Connecticut and California, and so we spent some time both on the East and West Coast while I was growing up as well. But I spent much of my childhood in Africa.
And I noticed, too, in your biography that for a number of years, almost a decade, I think, you worked in the State Department, one of the, I guess, titles, Regional Medical Officer and Counselor of Embassy for Medical Affairs. And so if I'm picturing this correctly, you were sort of the doctor or one of the doctors in charge of handling medical issues for, I mean, many or all of our embassies abroad. Is that accurate?
I really enjoyed my career in government and my time in the Department of State. In fact, I'm actually retired now as a Foreign Service Officer, Minister Counselor, which is equivalent of a 2-star rank as a military officer, and they have the rank equivalent of that.
Wow.
I really enjoyed living and working abroad. I spent quite a bit of time in Southern Africa, where I spent a lot of focus on the then just evolving issue of HIV/AIDS. I had the privilege of writing the first legislation on that with a guy named McDermott from Seattle, who was a congressman, and I'm very active with advising our ambassadors on how to address that. I moved from there. My next assignment was to Moscow, where I was actively involved during a period of transition from the Soviet Union to Russia. Very interesting time.
So were you providing direct medical care or just doing policy planning and that type of thing?
A little of both.
Huh. And the time in the former Soviet Union transitioning to Russia, I can imagine, was tumultuous to say the least.
Well, it was really interesting. My boss at the time was Ambassador Strauss, who had been the head of the DNC during the time when Carter was elected, and he was actually Bush's ambassador. So it was a very interesting combination, and it was an extremely exciting time.
Huh. So I imagine having grown up in Africa, essentially, and then had this incredible experience both in the military and then in the Department of State, that it obviously informs your worldview, and that you're both, as an American and as someone who has seen how America is perceived by the rest of the world, it seems to situate you perfectly for your current role at IBM.
Well, I've really been blessed and fortunate in that I love to travel and understand other cultures. And I kind of see, from my perspective and my heritage, I kind of see the current healthcare system as a form of violence, I suppose, in many ways. I mean, it's just so desperately needs to be transformed into a much more effective way of delivering and managing a population that exists now. You know, we really have some of the best specialty care in the world. We really do great knees and hips and livers. And I think when people talk about the United States having the best care in the world, I think maybe that's what they're thinking about. But if you look at the data, you look at the numbers, you know, we spend twice as much for our health care for the lowest value proposition in terms of years of life lived from age 40 for 15 years on. So that's probably the best indicator. We're 47th, I recall, in infant mortality, overall 37th. And for as much as we spend, we should be much better off than that. And I think part of the reason is we focused so much on developing the best rescue care probably in the world that we've neglected robust advanced primary care and using that primary care in a proactive rather than a reactive manner.
When you say that our medical system is essentially a form of violence, do you mean because it lacks this holistic view of, you know, the patient as a person and rather as sort of a collection of body parts for which we can do great partialist
care?
Yes,
I mean, we have so many people who slip through the cracks, right? I mean, it's just unacceptable. I mean, we literally have the equivalent of a 747 load of patients dying every day from, in essence, medical errors, right? From,
right.
You know, from the Air is Human report that the IOM put out. I mean, that's pretty old data, but I mean, that should be unacceptable, right? That should be as unacceptable as an airline industry allowing that to happen every day.
So I want to ask, because you're with, you know, a multinational, you know, huge player, IBM, and because of your background in multiple cultures, how does either in your current position or IBM, the company, I mean, I imagine you have very, in a sense, well-heeled corporate customers that use IBM products. How does IBM or how do you in your position handle or think about sort of the global divide in terms of wealth? I mean, the haves, the have-nots, the digital divide, so to speak. When you think about that issue, or those sets of issues, how does that frame your work? Because, I mean, I imagine you're working with some of the most advanced technology known to humankind, and then there are places, you know, that are so resource-deprived, you know, on this earth. How do you reconcile those things?
You know, it's really fascinating because when you look at China or Africa, what we've seen is that there's an ability to take technology and leapfrog. So, you know, you don't see a lot of landlines, you know, dug across the savannah in Africa, but you see everybody having a cell phone. In some ways, the communication is years ahead because they're not held hostage by a legacy system. So, I'm extremely optimistic that technology and data can really help transform and deliver care more effectively. I helped put together a solution for the most remote inhabited island on the face of the earth, Tristan da Cunha. It's 275, 300 people that live in the deep South Atlantic, only accessible by a seven-day boat journey from Cape Town. And we put in process an ability to use the internet, their satellite internet option, to get some of the best care in the world, with working with University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and technology. We took that same technology and we put it in the remote part of Pakistan with the support of the State Department. So, I think that what's exciting about healthcare is that we're moving into a world in which we're no longer trapped by how far the car can drive to deliver pretty significant level of care.
And I see what you mean. So by leapfrogging, it's almost like a quantum leap. It's almost Star Trekian. We can sort of beam solutions to where they need to go in hard to reach places.
Exactly. I mean, there's really three things driving this transformation. You know, one is unsustainable cost, which we're already off the cliff on, and every other country is approaching the cliff. The other is data, the ability to really make data actionable is something that we didn't have until now. I mean, tools like Watson, which can sort through 300 million pages of data and, you know, some microseconds and deliver it to the point of care as profoundly powerful clinical decision support, you know, will literally transform what we use the doctor's mind for, right?
Right.
No longer will they be data storage repository units. We're going to, like every other industry, you know, use tools to do that. And then the last thing is just this vast change in communication away from, you know, whites of your eyes to having devices that do that. Already we see places like Denmark having, you know, 82% of their encounters asynchronous, Kaiser half asynchronous. So, we're really moving into a world where hopefully, you know, we can put some tools. But we really think of helping to try to make healthcare smarter, right? That's what IBM really wants to do.
And I just want to emphasize that point. So you're saying over 80% of patient encounters in the country of Denmark are asynchronous. And by that you mean it's not a patient in front of a doctor at the same time, but rather a patient putting out a question or query or a need, getting a medical professional to respond to them sort of in due course through an electronic means or of some sort.
That's right. And for example, when you take your pill, right, if you're a diabetic and you take your pill and you push that pill through the aluminum foil in your pill dispenser, all of a sudden that information goes into your personal health record and your doc knows whether you took your pill or not. I mean, that's asynchronous communication, right?
Very smart. Well, this has been a great conversation. Paul Grundy, thank you so much for appearing on Studio Tulsa.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Paul Grundy is Global Director of Healthcare Transformation at IBM and the founder and president of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative. Dr. Grundy will be in Tulsa June 4th to keynote the MyHealth Access Network community event that will take place in the Learning Center of the Schusterman campus of OU Tulsa. The event is free and open to the public, but reservations are required in advance by calling event sponsor the Community Service Council of Tulsa at 918-931-9813. That's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.